What a thrill it is to be with you this morning. It's been a long time since I've been in this building. I was telling somebody earlier the last time I was here. It was back in the mid-70s when Brother Cleon Lyles was preaching a meeting here. And I remember being here then. And yes, at that time, as was mentioned, I was in Douglas, Kansas, just down the road here. Someone mentioned that was before I was married, but just barely. I was on the way to Oklahoma Christian for my first day of school, and the weekend before that, Monday, my dad, who preached at Miami, Oklahoma, got a call from Douglas, and they had had an awkward and unexpected need for a fill-in preacher for a while, and so he said, my son's going to school, he'll stop by on the way and preach for you on Sunday, which I did. I got to school there that Monday, and met my wife for the first time, and the next Sunday I was there, and I asked one of the elders, I said, you're looking for a preacher, why not just hire me? I was 18 at the time. And Brother John Alley, one of the elders there then, said, well, we're really looking for a married man. And I said, well, if you give me just a couple of months, I can take care of that. And sure enough, we got married over the Christmas break, and I moved there in the spring, and that's where things started. And so that's been several years ago now. And so before I was married, but just barely. You didn't bring me up from Tulsa to talk about that, though. Nor am I here to talk about things that are so obvious that all of us know about these things. You know, as well as I do, we live in a world that is sick. It's getting sicker and sicker every day. It's a world where it seems like things are just topsy-turvy. Black is white is black, good is bad is good. Evil is lauded and applauded, and good and righteousness are made fun of and ridiculed. It's a sick, sick world we live in. And you know, and I know, that God expects something more of us who are His children. Rather than just join in with the world, we are to be distinctive from it. And we are to put God and His Word and His kingdom first in our lives. You know that. The Apostle Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9 that his aim was above all else to be pleasing, well-pleasing, to be accepted of Christ Jesus. And Paul didn't just say that there. Remember in Romans 12 where Paul reflects upon the great and grand mercies of God as seen in allowing Gentiles as well as Jews to come to him by Christ. And Paul says as the 12th chapter of Romans begins, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. God expects us to put Him first and to sacrifice ourselves to Him and to His cause and to be unlike, transformed from the world. But again, you know that. Our question this morning is, why aren't we doing a better job of it? And what can we do about that? It is the fact that in so many cases, in so many places, all those who are Christians sometimes aren't Christians by how they live and how they think and by the priorities they show. It is often the case that we who wear the name of Christ fail to live up to that name and fail to have the urgency we should have in living the Christian life. And it's one thing to bemoan the fact that we're off course, many of us. It's something else to get us back on course again, to realize just what we need to do to become better and stronger and more faithful in the Lord's service. And with that in mind, I'd like to take you to a passage this morning. Really, it's a book in our Bible class, and it might seem to have nothing to do with this idea of faithfulness to Christ, but if you'll give me a little time to convince you, I think you can see we're in the right place. We're going to be in, and before I say this, you're going to hear it and say, I might as well go to sleep, but stay awake a little bit longer, but we're going to the book of Ecclesiastes. And we're going to start with the finish and then finish with the start. Go to chapter 12, if you would, in the book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to find how the whole thing ends, which again you know, perhaps better than I do. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, beginning at verse 9. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books, there is no end. And much study is wearisome to the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. And as you see in that last, the great and grand conclusion of the book, the wise man Solomon sees himself exactly where we were talking about a moment ago, and this idea of the absolute urgency and need of those who are God's putting God first, seeing their life's purpose, their reason for being as respecting God and keeping, holding true to his commandments. In view of the coming judgment, living for God as God expects us to live for him. But that's the end of the book. That's the conclusion of the whole matter. As you well know from past studies, the book of Ecclesiastes, at least viewed through one lens, is a terribly negative, sour, and dour book. The catchphrase, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. In fact, that phrase is found at the very first of the book, chapter 1 and verse 2. It's found at the very end of the book. In fact, the verse just before we started reading a moment ago, in verse 8. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity, here in the 12th chapter. And if that's the first and that's the last, you can expect the middle to be much like it. And the reason that it seems negative and sour and dour is because in the absence of the grand conclusion, Solomon shows just how meaningless everything is in the absence of that understanding. That's the purpose of the book, to show that there is one conclusion of life's purpose. In the absence of understanding that, nothing else makes sense. Nothing else matters. There is no reason for life or living. There is no reason for growth. There is no hope for the future. All is hopeless. Now you know, and I know from reading the news, it seems like all is hopeless. You look at the news of what's going on in the Middle East, in Europe, it seems hopeless. You look at the political landscape in this country, the corruption in high places, the crime rate, all seems to be hopeless. You look across the street, across the alley at your neighbors, it seems life is hopeless. You look at your own family situation sometimes, and it seems like life is hopeless. You look in the mirror, hopeless. In the absence of understanding what life is all about, it's just hopeless. And that's why you see so much hopelessness in the eyes of your neighbors, in the voices of your non-Christian friends, in the newscasts on all the stations on the internet and the television. In the absence of understanding what life is about, nothing else makes sense and everything is hopeless. And I'll tell you the truth. You strip God and Christ, the Word of God, the kingdom of heaven, the concepts of heaven and hell and man's immortal spirit, you rip that from reality, and what you're left with is a preacher standing right here that'll tell you, we have no reason to live. We have no reason to go forward. We have no hope. There is nothing to look forward to. But you put all of that back in, and see things as they really are. You realize there is a God in heaven. Christ is His Son. The Bible is His Word. The kingdom, the church, is His and can be ours. Heaven can be our home. We have a spirit. There's a judgment one day. God loves us. And all of this takes what would otherwise be hopeless despair and gives us the very hope of our calling. But to get there in Ecclesiastes, Solomon has to go through some ugly places. Some things that just don't work. If you ask a lot of people today, what is it that life's all about? What'll make you happy? What'll give you some reason to get up in the morning and get around? Well, Solomon deals with many of those ideas apart from God. And he comes back to that same conclusion. It's all vanity. There's more problems than not when you pursue these areas. And so I'd like to do some reading with you. If you'll turn back to the first of the book of Ecclesiastes. And before I make any comments on the reading, I'm going to just put some passages together. And we'll read for a bit here. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Beginning at verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind, for in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And let's start in chapter 2 now. And I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness. And of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven and all the days of their lives. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no prophet under the sun. And now to chapter 5, beginning at verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. For those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, so to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And now to chapter 10, quickly. Beginning at 5, there is an evil I have seen under the sun, and as an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, while the rich sit in a lowly place. I have seen servants on horses, while princes walk on the ground like servants. There's a lot more to the book than just that. We have a digested amount of time here and space to spend our comments this morning, but this suffices to give a flavor, not just for the tone and tenor of the book, but some specific ideas that are matters of vanity and false inspection in the view of the inspired Solomon here. He talks about wisdom first. Wisdom. Now, in our language, we usually divide and distinguish knowledge from wisdom by saying that knowledge is the accumulation of facts and wisdom is the understanding of what to do with them. The common sense to know how to take those facts and make some use of them, to apply them in a way that would be of benefit. And there are times when the Bible does distinguish the words just like that. At other times, both words will be used to mean the entire matter of both facts and their use. Many times in Proverbs, for example, Solomon will use the word wisdom to include knowledge and knowledge to include wisdom. But the idea of Solomon here is that the pursuit of knowledge and even an understanding of what that knowledge means in the absence of the divine amounts to nothing more than just a blind alley. And I think you realize this from personal experience. Now, I'm not a wise man. And before you say I agree with you, you're not either. There are those outside this room on any number of subjects a lot wiser and smarter and more intelligent than we are. But we've seen enough and learned enough to realize knowing things and even knowing what things mean, this is not all it's cracked up to be. There was a time when I knew nothing. And then there was a short time when I knew everything. And I'm about to circle back because it seems like, and you know what I'm talking about, in many areas, the more you learn, really, in whatever subject you're in, the less you know. You'll find in the verses preceding those we started with in Ecclesiastes 1, Solomon puts out some imponderables about the physical laws of this world and the universe. All the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Things that are still difficult for us to fathom, understand, get a grip on. And you reach a field of study and think, I'm going to learn all there is to know about this. And you get about halfway into it and realize you've got more questions at the middle than you had at the first. And there never is an end to it. But if you could learn everything about everything and could be, in terms of knowledge and understanding, omniscient, if you could know everything, the problem is, and if you've had kids, you know what I'm talking about, there's nothing more frustrating than knowing the answers and having nobody ask the questions or care that you have the answers. You spend a lifetime accumulating all this knowledge and nobody wants to hear it. Nobody could care less about what you know. And so Solomon says, what's the use? What is the purpose? Well, in the absence of God, there is none. Amen. You add to that the fact if you strip away the reality of eternity, and the immortal soul. You build all of this knowledge and wisdom, and from the world's perspective, once you die, it's just gone. So what's the use? What is the use? It's just a striving after the wind. It's all vanity. Then he talks about something that perhaps some of us know more about than others, but the pleasures of this life. Some illicit and wrong by their very nature. Others benign and yet wrong if taken to excess. But all of which, in the absence of an understanding of relationship and responsibility toward God, all of which are meaningless. I can't imagine being in a position like Solomon was. He said, anything I saw that I wanted, I could have. I've never have been in that. I'm glad I haven't. Can you imagine, based upon the immaturity many of us had years ago, if that had been the case, if anything we could have imagined, we could have had. And that's one blessing I'm thankful the Lord didn't curse me with. But Solomon had it. Because of all of his riches and his position as the king, if he saw it, and he wanted it, he could have it. And you'd think, in fact, from what you hear on the commercials and the advertisements and see in the movies and shows and tabloids, from what you hear from Hollywood, you'd think, well, that surely is the answer to everything. If you can just have all you want, whenever you want it, with no limits, if you can just live life to excess every day, it's got to be a world and a lifetime of pure bliss and happiness. Now, you know that's not true. You know it's not true. Amen. Now, when it comes to pleasure and bliss, a lot of us are, that's the way about like we're about money. I don't want all of it, just a little more than I have now. But those who have the most unbridled pleasures in this life also have, in almost every case, the largest amount of misery of those in this life. Ever see these? I haven't, so I don't know what I'm talking about just now, but I've seen reports about them. These reality shows about the rich and famous people and the way they live their lives. I don't know who the Kardashians are, except they're always in the news. I don't know why they're in the news. I don't know who they are. I know what one or two of them look like because I can't get them off my television screen. But for some reason, we have just become enthralled with what they do on a daily basis. I brush my teeth and nobody cares. They brush theirs, the whole world watches and sets their DVR to get it. I don't understand it. But I do know this from hearing about people like them who seem to have all they could possibly ever imagine having, who live lives as one perpetual party from morning till evening every day. They're not happy. They're just not happy. How can you not be happy getting your way all the time and doing what you want 24 hours a day? How can you not be happy? Solomon tells us, because a pursuit of pleasure in the absence of responsibility toward God is meaningless. It's fruitless. For one thing, pleasure is like any other addiction. Before it's entered into, it seems so wonderful. It seems so magical. It seems so life-altering, life-changing. The minute you have it, you've got it. And to get the same high you had to get there, you've got to have more going forward. And you reach a point of no return, yes, but also a point beyond which you really can't have any more excess and stay living. And so you grow numb. And this pleasure that seemed so life-altering early on now becomes a weight and a burden and an addiction to go and seek and do your best to try to find a higher thrill next time than you had the last time. And in your quiet moments of reflection, when you're not high on something, you ask yourself, what does all this mean? What does it all mean? And you'll end up exactly like Solomon. It means nothing. It's all purposeless. It's all without meaning. It's all vanity of vanities, says the preacher. But I'd like to spend a little more time on this next. I think most of us are not sidetracked by searches for wisdom, because most of us realize we're not that wise anyway and probably never will be. When it comes to pleasures, we know from experience that probably be nice to have some, but too much is too much, and that's a false avenue. But this next one, it traps many of us. Money, material things, the things of this world. It's always been a big distraction for Christians. Christ talked about it. Remember, he talked about how it's impossible to serve two masters. And he concludes that in the last of Matthew 6 by saying, can't serve God and mammon. And then shows in the next few words there that by serving mammon, he's talking about the worry and the care and the anxiety about simple necessities of life, like what we're going to eat or what we're going to drink or what we're going to put on the way of clothing, which things the Gentiles seek after, which worries cause him to say to us, oh, you of little faith. That anxiety, that worry, that underlying covetousness is that decision we've made to serve not the God of heaven, but the God of this world, mammon. It's always been a problem. Well, Paul will talk in 1 Timothy chapter 6 about the love of money being the root of all evil, which while some have coveted after they pierced themselves through with many sorrows, it's the case. It's always been a problem, this distraction the devil places in front of God's people to woo them away from righteousness toward the things, the trappings, the money, the stuff of this world. John will say in 1 John 2:15, love not the world nor the things that are in the world. It's always been a problem. And so Solomon looks at it long before New Testament days. And who could look at it better than Solomon, the richest of all those of his era, perhaps in history? The wealth of Solomon just astounds us, even today. And sometimes we get so caught up in realizing that we're not ever going to have that kind of wealth, we think, well, none of this applies to me. I'm no Solomon. I'm no Bill Gates. I don't operate in the billions or even millions. I'm just an ordinary person. So this isn't my problem. Money's not my problem. Let me tell you, it may be. You don't have to have a lot of money to be covetous. Covetousness has more to do with desire, interest, and attitude than it does possession or amount. But Solomon shows us just what a folly all of this is. We read in the 5th chapter a moment ago from Ecclesiastes what he says about the love of silver and gold, money, stuff. And he says, he that loveth silver, not satisfied with silver. He that loves gold within, it's not satisfying. And what you have is never enough. If that's the covetous mindset you have, what you have is never enough. I remember those days in Douglas years ago. I won't tell you what I made, but it wasn't much. But there wasn't much around anyway then. But I remember that I had just enough to be married. And then we had a child. And we got a little more, but then we had just enough to be married and have a child. And over the years, like many of you, my income has gone up. I've never been in want or lacking, but it's interesting that, as Solomon says, every time income increases, the mouths that eat increase as well. The outflow increases along with the income, so you're always about in the same place. When we lived years ago, spent 10 years in Liberal, Kansas as the preacher there, one of our members, and he was also one of the elders there, a fairly wealthy man, worked for the oil company as an executive. His wife once told us in private, she said, "You know, all of us are poor in our own income bracket." And that didn't mean so much then as it has come to mean later. I know exactly what she means. What she was talking about was, whatever income bracket you're in, you find a way to be real quickly in just as tight a position as you were before you got there. And if you don't do it by choice, oftentimes circumstances will force you into that situation where there's always a place for your money to go, and you're never left with much on top of what you need to get by. But let's say you're like Solomon, and that's not a problem. You've got income and disposable income and disposable income. You've got more than you can possibly dream of using in a lifetime. What then? Well, the problem is, so often then, in your mind, in your imagination, in your desires, you're never satisfied with what you have. You want to have more. But even if that's not the case, if you can be satisfied with what you have and where you are, you have to realize the vanity of it all, in the sense that you spend a lifetime accumulating all of this wealth and you die. And you know you can't take it with you. We've talked about the fact there are no pockets in a shroud. You know, I was in a meeting a few years ago, and there was a lady there that worked for the church that actually, she didn't work for the church, she was a member of the church, but she worked at her home, and her job was, she made shrouds. I had never known anybody that made shrouds. She was in her 90s, by the way, and long since passed from this life by now. I don't think I've ever seen a shroud, but I always grew up hearing there's no pockets in one, no pockets in a shroud. And you can imagine why. Can't take it with you. There's no U-Haul behind the hearse. It means the same thing. You can't take it with you. You know that. And so what happens to it? Here's what Solomon talks about in the fifth chapter. You leave it. And these are his words, not mine. Don't get on me about this. You leave it to fools. Now, I didn't call your kids and your grandkids fools. Solomon did. Take it up with him when you see him. But he was right. How many estates have you seen that have been well kept, well ordered, and built meticulously over the years, and then the minute the estate owners die, their kids and grandkids just waste it like no effort was ever involved in building it? It's gone. Very few wealthy families of 100 years ago still are. There are a few, but they're the exception, not the rule. You'll have those who build the fortune. You've got the next that tends to the fortune, and the next generation after that that wastes and loses the fortune. And so what's the use? Well, in the absence of God, there is absolutely no purpose or no use to any of it. But then our time is escaping us. One last thing. He talks about wisdom, vanity. Pleasure, vanity. Wealth, vanity. And then that interesting passage we read in chapter 10 about that folly that comes from the ruler. And long story short, what he's saying here is that those who have power over others, in a good many cases, they don't deserve the position they've got. They waste it when they have it. And there's no, from the perspective of anybody wise, it makes no sense. They're where they are, and what they do makes no sense to anybody that's watching them. You think, if I could just be in power, if I could be president, oh, I'd change things. Well, anybody in the right mind, well, let me rephrase that. Anybody running for president, anybody that chooses to run for president right now, doesn't have the right mind to be one. Given the state our world is in, the mess we're in, the attacks they're going to get, anybody that chooses to be president doesn't have the mind to be one by choosing to be one. But we need one. But I'm not here to talk about the president. In general, it's not true that the one thing you're missing is some control over people around you. If I just had some power, if I just had some clout, if I just had some real influence, if I was somebody in the right circles, then I'd be happy. Solomon says no. Now, when it comes to Solomon, he has a position from which we should be listening, because he's got wisdom. He has all the pleasures he can amass. He has all the money and material things he can put together. He has all the power one can imagine as king of Israel. He's got all of these things. And with them, and in spite of them, he says, vanity. Which tells me something and should tell you something. We're not going to find happiness in those places either. Because I don't care how wise you are, you won't be as wise as Solomon. And it wasn't enough for him. I don't care how much pleasure you have, you won't have as much of it as Solomon had, and it wasn't enough for him. Doesn't matter how much money you have, you won't have as much as Solomon did, and his didn't make him happy. And it does not matter how much power you have. You may be legislator, you may be a congressman, you may be a senator, you may be president, you may be the king of the world. You won't be what Solomon was, but he wasn't happy. Which then leads him at the end of the book with a question. What does bring happiness? What is life's purpose? Now, I think our time, when is our time up? Well, that means nothing. Okay, there's a passage I want to look at with you in the last of Ecclesiastes that before the conclusion is something we usually overlook, but it's the key to this entire matter. The last of Ecclesiastes, his words which seem contradictory about the wisdom and knowledge in the books, he says that these words that he's written down, they're acceptable, they're upright, they're like the words of the wise, which are like goads, and the scholars, their words are like well-driven nails. Be admonished by these. This next verse after that is a contrast of making many books. There is no end, and of much study, wearisome to the flesh. What he's saying is, you listen to true wisdom. And that wisdom is that which does not just include but begins with the fear of the Lord. Those words of wisdom are like well-driven nails, like the goads that keep the oxen going in the right direction. They're to be listened to. The problem is, you've got a flood of words in acres and acres of volumes of books, which the amount of books and words seem to have no end. And those well-spoken, wise words, which are like goads and well-driven nails, it's like trying to find a needle in the haystack, to find the true wisdom among all the foolishness that's out there written down. This was before the internet. This was before Gutenberg. This is before people had their own libraries in their home. And yet even at this point, Solomon realizes there's a lot more information out there than there is truth. And that's our problem. The reason we are so distracted right now in this world, we've got a world of information. And the truth is still there. It's still here. Being right before God still is the right way to go. Putting Him first, fearing God and keeping His commandments, this is still the whole duty of man. But this truth is lost in a world of words. And so our decision is listening to the right source, listening to the words of truth from God, and deciding based upon those to find meaning in life in Him rather than being distracted by the vanity of life that is presented by Hollywood and the internet and books and friends and neighbors and people that would do their best as Satan's minions to draw us away. And we'll be dealing with these things as the week goes forward, putting first things first. Thank you.